Hello and welcome to an episode of Everything is Canada, Centrelink's podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the best way is to email me at steve@centrelink.com, or you can always find me on Twitter at SteveDunk5 or at EverythingCanon. Today in the show, I'm talking to Zoraida Cordova all about her new book, The Inheritance of Orquídea Divina, which is described as perfect for fans of Alice Hoffman, Isabel Allende, and Sarah Addison Allen. This is a gorgeously written novel about a family searching for the truth, hidden in their past, and the power they've inherited. Starting with an amazing cover by artist Eric Davila, and opens with about as good a letter to the reader as you're going to find by the book's editor, Melanie Iglesias, The Inheritance of Orquídea Divina instantly gives you a sense you're in for something special. In what feels like a classic already, Zoraida crafts something so unique, so distinct in this day and age, it's awfully difficult to pin down. Folks, this is storytelling. We talk about the long journey this book took to write, the highs and lows of the publishing industry, The Inheritance of Orquídea Divina, of course, and much, much more. While this is a spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out, so if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now, but definitely double back once you've read it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always, around these parts, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves. Each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or safely face-to-face, or each time we participate in the market with our purchasing choices. A reminder that September is National Hispanic Heritage Month in the U.S., so please support the Hispanic communities in any way that you can. Since we talk books here, I'm going to provide a list of some, but not all, of course, Hispanic authors who, along with my guest today, kick all kinds of ass, and you can support them not just this month, but all year long. So look for that link later. Finally, September 30th is International Podcast Day, and you know who's got a pretty good podcast? My guest, Zoraida Cordova, is the acclaimed author of more than a dozen novels and short stories, including the Brooklyn Brujas series, Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, A Crash of Fate, and is the co-editor of the best-selling anthology Vampires Never Get Old. In addition to writing and editing, she serves on the board of We Need Diverse Books, which sort of makes her my boss. I'll explain why in a second, as well as the co-host of the excellent writing podcast Deadline City, along with a god who walks among us, Danielle Clayton. Zoraida was born in Guayaquil, Ecuador, which is important for not only the fact that she was born there, but also because it features heavily in this book. She still calls New York City her home. When she's not working, she's roaming the world in search of magical stories. Speaking of which, she's here today to talk about her new book, The Inheritance of Orquídea Divina, which is described as perfect for fans of Alice Hoffman, Isabel Allende, and Sarah Addison Allen. This is a gorgeously written novel about a family searching for the truth hidden in their past and the power they've inherited. My apologies for screwing up every pronunciation that I just said. Please welcome to the show, Zoraida Cordova. Hi, Zoraida.
Hi. Thank you for such a great introduction.
Yes. Sorry for screwing it up. I will.
No, you did. You pronounce The Inheritance of Orquídea Divina correctly. That's solid.
But your hometown, though, I butchered it, didn't I?
Oh, no, it's fine. It's Guayaquil.
Like Guayaquil. Okay. Yeah. Guayaquil. That's important because it's going to come up again. So Guayaquil. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I haven't really made a big deal about this yet, but I am now a blogger for We Need Diverse Books.
Awesome.
So you are my boss.
hardly.
I'm very excited about that, actually. My first piece has come out. When do they come out? Soon. September. I've got one with Vera Hurunandani for her great new book, How to Find What You're Not Looking For. And then I think about a month after that, I've already spoken to them, Lillian Rivera for We Light Up the Sky. I don't know if you've read that one yet, but
I did read it. I loved it.
Isn't that so amazing?
Yeah, it's such a weird book, but it kind of reminds me not of The Sixth Sense, but like the way that The Sixth Sense made alien movies about the people and not about like the invasion.
That you know was what I mean? 100%. And that was like the basis of our conversation too. When I talked to her, it was all about sort of,
oh, nice.
It's more than just a metaphor, right? Like it's so many different things, and we don't want to spoil the book obviously for people, but in such a great way, she, you know, yeah, makes us look at ourselves. And I love the way she has like the planet, the sort of, mm-hmm. the, you know, is used as a weapon against us and stuff. And anyways, super cool. Definitely recommend that book. Absolutely. So yeah, I'm very excited. Those two are coming out next couple of months, and I'm very happy to be doing a small part with We Need, because I love that site and I've love everybody involved with it. And yeah.
So. Yeah. WNDB is so great.
Oh, amazing. And I'm just super, like I said, you can tell I'm giddy over it. I'm so happy to be part of it. So I can't wait to, I've got some good stuff coming up this fall too. So the last time we spoke, which was, feels like a, fuck, it feels like 10 years ago, doesn't it? With the way the world works, but, which was for Star Wars book, A Crash of Fate, which, as you know, I loved very much. In fact, I always think of two scenes, the end crowd scene when sort of like the bar crowd parts for Izzy, right?
Yeah.
And she approaches Jules and they have just that incredible moment together. And then of course, the cenote scene, you know.
Yes, the most romantic scene.
The two most romantic scenes are the ones I think about the most and have reread several times and just love that book so much. And I'm so, I'm smart enough not to ask if you're going to be doing more Star Wars because I know you can't answer, but.
Well, yeah, it's not up to me, but yep. You know, Lucasfilm knows where I live. They know everything about me.
That's right.
They know my blood type. It's totally fine.
That's true. Right. They have your DNA on file. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And there's a scope pointed at you right now somewhere. I'm sure someone's told them we're talking about it, but, I just love that book so much. And it's like, it's a small story in a big universe mm-hmm. type of thing. Right. And that's, it was such a great book and I loved it. And that's what I like more. I want more of that in Star Wars, more small. I want smallness. I want to really zero in on the people and have those intimate stories like that. And of course there's always implications to the larger thing, but anyways, loved it. Hope for more. I would love to see you back in that universe, but if not, that's their loss. All right. So I'm a process nerd. So let's talk a little process. And you wrote something somewhere that it took, this book was sort of 3 years-ish, took 3 years-ish to write. Some of that was you sort of had to like leave it and come back to it for different reasons and stuff like that. But it's, this is a very personal book to you. So let's talk about sort of go back in time and talking about, like just the birth of this whole story.
Yeah. So oddly enough, or maybe not, it's not that odd. The Inheritance of Rikita Divina started off as a short story in an anthology called Toil and Trouble, 15 Tales of Women and Witchcraft. And I think the anthology came out in 2017. It must have come out in 2017. So after I wrote the story, I had the image of this woman who transforms on the day of her death, right? And with her transformation, she gives over her power to her descendants. And that was it. That was the short story. And I met with an editor who wanted to work with me because she was from Ecuador as well. And she was like, you're one of the only Ecuadorian authors that I found. And she's always has her ear to the ground looking
Are you talking about Melanie?
No, not okay. Melanie. It's a different editor.
Okay.
Yeah, she's changed. Okay. So that editor, she bought my book. Her name is Johanna Castillo. She bought my book. Then she actually changed. So there was some like movement in her, in the publisher. And instead of like, essentially, you know, her favorite part of being an editor was developing author careers. So with this movement, she actually went back to agenting. So now she's an agent at Writer's House. Mm. And so I was inherited by Melanie Iglesias, who just really, really pushed me in a direction that, you know, pushed me out of my comfort zone. You know, the acquiring editor never got to read the book. Right. So yeah. Like it, you know, she was sort of like the mechanism. She made it happen. And she gave me this wonderful opportunity to write my first adult book because up until that moment, I guess I'd written YA fantasy and I hadn't written middle grade yet, but it was mostly YA. And some adult romance, but that's really a different space. And so this is my first, I hate to call it literary, but it's, you know, it's my first YA magical realism novel. Adult.
I was going to say, I was thinking, I'm like, yeah, I think
magical realism novel. Yeah.
You'll get used to it. Yeah.
And so, that's what, sort of where it started. And then because I, you know, I like to be very candid, I just took, I in that time period in the last 3 years of, actually it's been 4 years because we're now in 2021. You know, we sold the book in 2017, the end of 2017. And so during that, between the sale of that book and now, I went through three agents, right? So I left the agent that I had been with from the very beginning, who sold the book, or who did the deal. And, you know, it just wasn't a good partnership anymore. And we wanted different things. We saw, like, you know, we had different visions for my career. And I sort of took on more work than I could really, like, handle. And
was
so
she, was she your first agent? Sorry, did you say that or no?
Yeah, that was, she was my first agent. So, but so when we'd been together for like 10 years.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So we'd been together for 10 years and it's just, it's been interesting because, you know, I, my debut novel came out in 2012 and it's sort of this, when you're around in this business for so long, it's really hard to, it's hard to get publishers excited about your work when you're not like a flashy debut or like, you know, your book doesn't sell a million copies. And so it's, you know, I've just been very frustrated for like so much of my career. And then I moved on to a new agent and that agent was definitely, we did not work out. And then now I'm with my third agent. And so like my, that book has sort of seen the evolution of not just like my professional career, but myself as a writer. And that's really like, the process was so difficult because there was so much change happening in such a short amount of time that, you know, like I was depressed and then I like, I had too much work to do. And then I had, you know, like the deadline anxiety that comes with it. And then I finally, and then a pandemic, right? editing this book during a pandemic was also a nightmare for me. And but now it's here and it's happening. So
so yeah, so okay, a few things. We'll start with the most recent comment. So was editing during the pandemic, was that just because the world was fucking falling apart and you just didn't have that oomph that you needed to go through the editing process, which can be, you know, tough and arduous and you know, it's that's the job, part of the job in a lot of ways, right? Was it because of, was that the reason or just like what was?
No. So it was because, so my uncles were, my uncle, like the, that like, who's like my dad, basically him and his husband, they were both sick with COVID.
Okay.
And like, they were, you know, one of them was 70 and in the hospital for 4 weeks. Oof. And I just became like the emotional support of his husband, like my mom's brother. And so like, it was just a really devastating like month, just thinking like, is the worst thing that's going to happen right? And because they were both sick, but only one of them was sick enough to stay in the hospital. So it's, yeah.
It was a lot. Okay. So how are they doing now?
They're great. They're good now. They're okay. Good now. They couldn't, like, they had problems breathing, but once they got the vaccine, it alleviated some of that, like that pressure in their lungs and stuff like that. So, which is sort of like a anecdotal, side effect that people have been saying is happening. But there's not like enough data to say like, it'll cure your side effects.
Right. I mean, but I mean, if that's even a slight possibility, that's good information, right? So we got to combat all the negative bullshit. Well, that's good. I'm glad that they're both doing well now. So yeah, that's a lot. And then just sort of backtracking a little bit there, you had to grind it out, didn't you? Like it sounds like you paid your dues a little bit. And at any point during that process, you know, since 2012 till say up till last year, the year before, it sounds like, was self-doubt is a big fucking gross monster. Did you ever think this isn't for me?
Oh, absolutely. All the time. Yeah, I think that time, because, you know, I feel like I released, you know, my first, let me think about the best way to say this.
Sure.
You know, I think it comes from publishers are not careful in the way that they talk to authors.
Right.
So, you know, with my first series, my publisher said some remarks, and it was somebody at my publisher, like an edit, like the young adult acquiring editor in chief or whatever. She made like disparaging remarks about my book to a bookseller who was my friend, and I guess didn't know was my friend, and that really put a chink in my armor and of like confidence when it came to you know, the Brooklyn Bruja series, because she said that the book hadn't performed the way that the publisher wanted it. And I was like, I wasn't aware that there were any expectations. And so publishers, when they make such remarks and they talk about authors as these like machines that can sell books or not sell books, you know, while not actually supporting them, it causes a damaging effect to the author. And so like, for me, I was like, I didn't know that they had any expectations. I didn't know that, you know, they didn't really give me any marketing money. So I wasn't aware that my book was supposed to perform a certain way. And so like, that's an instance where, you know, and I tell people I'm an open book. So like, I am perfectly comfortable saying that, like, that relationship really hurt me later on with my next books and series and things like that. Because like, I, in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking like, oh, is the publisher happy? Do they want more? Like, what are they expecting from me? And so like, it just really sucks.
Well, it's, yeah. I mean, like, for really just all the obvious reasons, it sucks, right? Like, it's fucking crushing to your self-esteem, number one. Mm-hmm. It's crushing to your artistic ability, your craft, because, yeah, if you're constantly second-guessing yourself, it'd be like in the middle of your outlining process, you posted it online or something, right? And then just like, succumb to the whims and wishes of every idiot online who had something to say about it. You know, like it's,
yeah,
it's really
fine. Look, I can take feedback.
Of course. Oh yeah. No, we're not talking. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's come up a lot, especially the last little while, right? About the difference between good and bad feedback. And there's just like, obviously the fucking torrent of just total bullshit on things like Goodreads. As opposed to, if anything, you know, you should tell authors to have a trusted circle of people, right? That you can count on to give you honest, good feedback. Not I DNF'd at 13%. Here's my thoughts on the whole book and why I'm giving it one star. It's like, fuck you. You know, like it's, and like, or my new favorite crowd is, this isn't my usual thing. I don't really like this author, but I'm going to read it anyways, knowing I'm not going to like it. And then I didn't like it, so I'm going to give it one star. I'm like, fuck.
Oh yeah.
I'm like, oh God, I hate you so much.
Every author that I know says like this one reader who just hates us and has always hated us,
yeah,
but they still read our books every single time. Every author that I know has like that, you know, and like, whatever, it's fine. Like if you want to waste a day or a week,
right,
reading a book that, yeah, you know you're gonna hate by somebody you hate, that's your choice. But like, life is too short for that, man.
even like you see it with just like even genres. You're like, well, I don't like noir, but I read this noir, yeah, book. And so, because it's just like, who's I talking? I was talking to Margot Wood recently about her debut Fresh there. And mm-hmm. Yeah, we were just talking about how Goodreads has no algorithms, basically. It's just horseshit. But even something like Amazon, where people will give it 1 star out of 5 because they like the book, but the packaging was damaged.
That's just so crazy, because you're not like, this isn't about the packaging,
right?
This is about the content, right?
So they need to sort that out. And things like Goodreads need to get their fucking shit together. Like if you type the letters DNF, it should block you out from leaving a review, right? Like,
I mean, I saw something recently that I guess is happening with Goodreads. I don't want to talk about it because I don't actually know the full details, sure. But like I did see that there was an article about Goodreads today.
Oh, I didn't see it. Okay.
Yeah. And I'll look it up.
Cause yeah. I'm just like battling against Goodreads. I rail against it whenever I can. And it's, you know, the thing is too, like, I actually had an idea a few months ago. I was going to start reviewing Goodreads reviews. I'm glad I didn't, but we got to fix it. Storygraph's great. And we got to get more people on Storygraph, I think. But anyways, we don't want to turn this into that, but
yeah,
the long story is I'm so fucking happy that, you know, you grinded it out, you stuck it out. And you're one of these authors too, that's really great at helping other authors. And I fucking love that. And like, and what I said in my intro about, you know, God who walks among us, like I am a Danielle Clayton stan. She's one of your best friends. And I'm so jealous that you just get to talk to her, let alone share her space. She still doesn't get enough credit for what she's done.
No,
in my opinion, but,
in my humble opinion, she does not get enough credit.
Yeah. Okay. And you will would know better than I would. So that lends that statement much more credibility coming from me, but, I am such a huge, I'm in love with her. Basically, I've never met her, probably, you know, probably never will, but she's just so great. And again, definitely doesn't get enough credit, but I'm so happy you stuck it out. Cause I mean, the stories that you've given me the last few years alone, I mean, even if you were just writing for me, I'm happy you stuck it out. Cause I mean, even just like recent stuff, Universe of Wishes and your work with vampires, like so fucking great. And Inheritance, like I was saying offline, like I fucking love this book so goddamn much, and I can't wait for people to read it. Let's get into it a little bit. So this summary is way too long, by the way. It's a really long summary. So I don't normally like to ask this, so give me the elevator pitch, give me the elevator summary.
So The Inheritance of Arcadia Divina is about a woman who invites her family back to their homestead on the account of her death, to celebrate her death. And during that moment, she picks three of her descendants and gives them an inheritance, and that inheritance is magic. And so 7 years later, this unknown entity is sort of killing off the members of the Montoya family, and they don't know why. So they have to return to, Orquídea's birthplace in Guayaquil, Ecuador, to understand what their grandmother did and why this is happening to their family. But some secrets don't really want to be unearthed, and so they have a lot to deal with that. And yeah, this is the first time I've actually pitched it.
Okay. All right. So. Yeah. Well, then, you know what? I should have just read the summary, but it is actually kind of long.
The summary is too long.
Yeah. I don't want to, I'm a summary nerd, so I'm always like critiquing the summaries, but this is going to be non-spoiler, and this is a really hard book because, like, you know, there's so much of it that I could easily write off as plot, but then there's so much of that that I don't want anyone to know about until they read the book. So it's really tricky to talk about the non-spoiler. We'll do our best though, but let's start with the home base, Guayaquil, Ecuador. So obviously you were born there. Talk about why it's so special, because it's a big part of this book. It's essentially one of the two most important places in the book, right? I mean,
yes.
It inspires some of the most wonderful scenes, and it also is the home of, is it Kilka or Quilka?
Kilka.
Kilka, who...
So I made up this character. Kilka is a river monster.
Yeah.
And so Guayaquil is an important city. It used to be a great port city. And so a lot of ships, you know, were always coming in and out of the ports. There was a lot of trade, a lot of export and imports. And it, you know, Guayaquil was called the Pearl of the Pacific. And so it, you know, it's a city that it's small, you know, we're a small country. But it also has a lot of resilience, because, you know, Latin America is so complicated. And, you know, I consider myself Ecuadorian first. And then when I, you know, when I'm in groups of other Latinos, like I say Latino or Latinx.
Okay.
But you know, but being Ecuadorian is so unique and important to me, because I feel like I'm writing in a space that not a lot of people have written in the American market, or like the North American market, or English speaking market, I guess I should say.
Right.
And so, you know, Guayaquil is going to be presented in this way that a lot of people, this is going to be their first time reading about the city. And so for me as a writer, and as like somebody who was born there, I had to balance, you know, the not so pretty things with like these legends. Some of them are true, some of them are history, some of them are just from my fabrication. And so that's why the novel should be, you know, it's like, it's not historical fantasy. It's,
right.
it's magical realism. Right. And so Kilka is a character that lives in the river. And I came up with that character because when I was a kid, my uncle had one of my uncles, he had, a scar across the stomach, and it went like diagonally across his entire stomach. And so I asked him like, what happened? And he said that, he like wrestled a crocodile, and that's why he got it. And so there was this like crocodile monster in the river. And to this day, I don't actually think that's what happened. Like the cut is too clean now that I'm, you know, 34 and not a gullible little child.
Yeah.
I still thought about that, you know, cause I was thinking when I was creating the map of the city and where the characters need to go, I'm like, what's important? The thing that's important is the river, right? Like the neighborhood mm-hmm. that Arcadia lives in and her mom lived in. That's my town. That's like my neighborhood within the city. Like that's where I grew up, and that's where my whole family lived. And my grandmother, like Arcadia's mom, like if they hadn't like gone to like put their roots down on this place, like there would not be a neighborhood. Mm. Right. And so of course my grandmother is a lot nicer than Arcadia's mom. So
it's complicated. Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
So that's sort of where that comes from, right? And like and creating this river monster is just sort of like symbolizes that the river will always be there. Mm-hmm. No matter how the city changes around it, right?
That's one thing that's happening in the book too, because it, you know, like there's some timeline jumping and stuff, but the town is sort of on the cusp of, I guess, maybe modernization, maybe is a maybe not the best word to use, but people are starting to invest in it, and so that means taller buildings, right? And different things like this. So it's an old world, you know, crashing into the new world a bit, isn't it? And I like what you just said about, because that river's always going to be there, and it's been there forever, and it will always be there. What, and the banks could be lined with skyscrapers, maybe, but that river is still going to hold all these memories and Kilka, right? So I will say too that Kilka was the first time I cried in the book. I guess, I mean, listen, there's a funeral. It's not a spoiler to say that, you know, Arquita is you know, approaching death, I guess we'll say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and you know, because she, when she was younger, much younger, is the only person to actually see Kilka and certainly interact. And there's a really great line you wrote, and I'm just going to read it. And if I read it and you think I should cut it out, I'll cut it out. The ancient creature felt the day of Orquita's death, a connection carried from root to dirt to sea. And for the first time in centuries, the river monster wept. They were, after all, family in some way. Zoraida, I cried. I don't know why. I mean, I know why, but
yeah,
like tears. Like I shed tears over that part. I thought it's so, and at that point, that's okay. So we'll get to that in a second. Let's start at the beginning here though. Let's start with, cause the first thing you see obviously is this cover. And I was, you know, you saw that thing I put on Twitter today about Eric.
Eric Davila is so good.
Eric Davila is so amazing. And you must've just shit yourself when you saw this cover. It's so great.
Oh yeah.
Now, most times authors have little to do with the cover. Did you have anything to do with it, or just did you chip in a few ideas, or what was the process?
I did tell them, I did say to, so Atria is a phenomenal publisher. I couldn't even find something that I'm like to nitpick about them. They're just so incredible and the team is so supportive and wonderful. And I just feel really lucky to be able to have this book with them. So with, when I thought of what I wanted the book to be, the cover to be, I saw this image, right? A girl with an orchid at her throat. And that's what I told them that I wanted. I was like, I would love to see this image. Let's see how it works, if it works, right? And the cover changed a little bit. Like originally her hair was going to be roots, but it read to fantasy, like high fantasy. And so that's where we scaled back and just did like roses around her.
Okay.
And so there was actually another version of this cover. The one we revealed is different than the final cover, right? So like, if you want to see the original cover, it's on tour.com. But we changed it, we tweaked it because of accounts, right? Like bookseller accounts, book buyers and stuff like that.
Right.
And so it's still the same, but there's just a little bit, there's like more stars, or, you know, it is the perfect cover for me for this book. It's exactly what I wanted. If I'd want like a special edition cover, I would just want to put like a little blue rooster somewhere on it, like even if it's the spine.
Are you but like the Gabo version or the Jameson version?
The Gabo version. Yeah.
That would be so funny. And then people would be like, what the fuck is this? And they'd be like,
yeah,
you have to read the book.
Hopefully this book does well and gets a special edition at some point. And then it'll be like, here's a rooster.
Right. And then, And then once you read it, you're like, oh, of course. Now that's why. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So right away, this cover is so great. And I'm a hardcore cover to cover person too. So like, I read everything in it, like the front matter, the body and the end matter. So you open this thing and right away, you know, you start with on the inside of the actual cover. This is now I'm talking just for the arc now, whatever. We'll see what the final one looks like. But the letter to the reader is the first thing you see. Now, normally the authors write that. You had Melanie Iglesias Perez write this, who is the associate editor at Atria. And
she got a promotion. Amazing.
Good for her. She wrote this fucking beautiful letter to the reader. And I love that. And I've been on authors lately about these letters to the readers because they're only for the arcs typically, right? They don't usually make the mm-hmm. final. And I think I'm calling bullshit on that because these are so great and they're written so well and they provide so much context. I really think people should have access to this. But anyway, that's my rant.
I don't know why I think that the reason why they're specifically for like arcs and supplementary materials is because like, I think that they don't fit in like in finished, like the finished copies, right?
I
wish that they did.
Right. So here, one thing that happened earlier in the year, I was talking to Justina, right? Ireland, about Ophie's Ghosts. And I'm going to take some small credit for this because her letter to the reader was, again, incredible. And it just talks about, you know, it's a process, inspiration, all these wonderful things. So she ended up putting it online. She put it on her Twitter account.
That's nice.
Yeah, I think so. That's a good option, right? If it's not going to make the final copy, because it is.
Some books I do, I have author's notes, right?
Right. So, yep. Sure.
Yeah, but that's different. It's different letter to the reader.
I agree. It is different. And anyways, Melanie wrote a fucking beautiful letter to the reader here. And I love it so much. And that's how the book starts. Like I said, like this is even like before you get to anything. You know, the whole front matter of this book is great. And then you have, thank you for the family tree too, as well, because this is a, this is a huge cast. The Montoya, the Montoya family alone is, you know, it's like, it's everything. So you do this really great family tree at the beginning of the book, which I was constantly flipping back to. So it was so great. One of the things that Melanie says in her letter is, she wrote, this novel feels like coming home. And if someone said to me, describe this book in 10 words or less, that's what I would say. It's a novel that feels like coming home. This is how you tell a fucking story. All right. This book feels like a classic already to me. The setup is perfect. The execution is perfect. Like, I think it would be a dream to narrate as well. Like I kept hearing, do you know he's Mexican actor, Demian Bashir. He's been in, he was in a movie called Land. What else has he been in? Oh, he was the priest in, what scary movie was that? Anyways, he's a really, really, really cool actor. He's a really cool actor. He's from Mexico. He just has a really beautiful voice. And I just kept hearing his voice narrate this book as I was reading it. And it's just so pure. The storytelling to me is so pure. Like I don't know. It feels like a classic already, Zoraida. It really does. It's so great. And that's such a great way to put it about how it feels like coming home. This book feels like, it feels familiar, but it's not familiar, right? It's brand new shit. And talk to me about, because this is personal to you. Like, you know, how are you feeling now that it's done and close to coming out? Because it was an emotional journey for you. And it's so personal because it's your hometown and all these other reasons. Talk to me about being able to inject so much of yourself and your family essentially and your heritage and all this into not just a book, because it's not a memoir, of course, but I'm trying to tell you, this book is fucking genius. Like, I don't get it. But at the same time, it oozes out of this book to me. Like, it just feels so great. And that's why her line about this book feels like coming home, that is a perfect way to say it for me. So just if you can talk about sort of just like what, yeah, like that whole, that idea of how personal this book is to you and how you were able to translate that into a work of fiction, right?
Yeah. I mean, I had no idea that the reception of this book is going to be what it has been so far. You know, I've been getting like daily tags from people reading the ARCs. And it's really startling to me that people like you also as well, like, just feel so connected to it. I feel like the book is personal, and I keep saying that the book is personal because like it is the closest to me and my family that I'll probably ever get in a book. And you know, with magical realism included, right? Arcadia is really like based off of my grandmother a little bit. My grandmother obviously never made a Faustian bargain with anyone, but she, you know, she did move to the United States, you know, when in her, I think, 50s. With nothing, right? And just because she got one of those visa invitations from her sister who had already been here in New York in the 80s. And so like, you know, her survival of like learning a new language when you're already in your 50s, and she's, you know, she had a disability, she had a botched hip surgery when she was young, and then several botched hip surgeries like after that, like to try to repair, but you know, she's lived with this disability her whole life. But still, right, you know, she had six kids, and so like the personal part of it, of this book, is really these women who survive in despite any circumstance that comes about, right? And I wanted to show a different version of an immigrant story, because I feel like whenever you see Latinx people or Latinos in media, the most pervasive narrative is like a border crossing and like extreme poverty and sadness. And I didn't want to write that. Like, I think that, you know, you can write whatever you want for, you know, whatever experience you want. But like, for me, it was important to show like, yeah, these are humble beginnings and this was like hardship, but we made something magical out of it. And we can't always control the circumstances around how things happen, right? Like, we make certain choices. And then that coupled with something that I really wanted to see in Latinx literature, which is like talking about generational silence. And I feel like, you know, generations of families have this, like, they don't talk, right? Like, now I have all of my cousins are in therapy in a good way, right? Because they recognize their, I guess, zillennials or whatever. Whatever the new term, maybe they are Gen Z.
I think
all of my cousins who are in their early 20s, they're all in, you know, like they see a therapist and like as part of their like, you know, regular thing. And like, for me, that would have been unheard of like 10 years ago with even my family, who like, I feel like is like, I have a wonderful family and I love every one of them, but like, you know, we all have our issues.
Of course.
And so it like, I really wanted to talk about generational silence and how it impacts different generations, in books. And so that's sort of where it's personal and like it, writing something like this was really difficult. But because I was afraid, right? And like, I'm always afraid of people reading my book and like saying that like it sucks. And like, that's something that I can't control. But at the end of the day, like, I'm gonna write the most honest book that I can and hope that it resonates.
Yeah. Well, just diving a little deeper into what you were just saying there, like, a lot of it is especially for the Latinx community the last couple of years. And I mean, like, you know, what I said on the intro, yeah, like, we're recording this in August, but September is Latin, you know, Heritage Month. And I just started writing down some authors for that link I'm going to post, and my hand got tired. The difference, you know, now it feels good now. I mean, there's still a long ways to go, but like, I'm looking at my bookshelves and it's full of names like, yeah, Cordova, Rivera, Oshira, Garcia, Mikado, you know, older, right? Like, Macklemore, Silvera. Like, I'm looking at them all. Like, I'm caught, like, there's tons, and the quality is so great. And one of the things, like, sort of what you were just saying is, yeah, there's this generational silence, but, you know, you're in a lot of ways, like you said, because of the way it's portrayed in the media, right? Which is fucking horseshit, obviously. There is this culture there, this beautiful culture. And I think the job of, you know, all these wonderful Latin ex authors, writers, storytellers is taking control of that narrative, right? And presenting it in a way that says, yeah, look, we're just like everybody else. We're not a monolith, right? Ignore what this media is depicting us as. Here's the truth. And in order to have this generational silence to begin with, you have to be generational. And it does go back so far. And it's people like you that are giving us this the honor of reading these stories, like allowing us, you're opening the doorway, you know, at the bottom of the pond. No one will get that until they read the book. To go back and explore these parts and these stories and these families, right? But in order to do that, that has to exist. And it's really great. I mean, talk about sort of having, like, when you, was that instilled in you at a young age of like knowing how far back, you know, these generations go? And because, I mean, you know, just sort of comparing it to, say, like, sort of the Black experience where their histories were erased, right?
So I think that no, like, we didn't, you know, to a certain point, like, I don't really know anyone before my great grandparents.
Right.
And I think it's just the most important thing, at the, you know, in the times of like my grandmother, my great grandmother, was like survival. Right. So like, there's also so much movement. Right. So like, my grandmother, she remembers she moved to La Tarazana, which is where Orquídea takes place, in her youth takes place. And she remembers, like, and we came from the Barrio Cuba, so like it was like a neighborhood called Cuba in Guayaquil. And then before that, you know, I asked her where do they come from? And so like they have like vague notions of where her grandparents came from, but like they just don't know. And I think that because in Latin America, the movement is to erase brown identities and to just sort of create this like quote unquote Ecuadorian identity or like Latino identity that's like mixed. Mm-hmm. And so like they erase everything else. And that's something that's like really pervasive in Latin America. And I hate that because like you're denying like your indigenous roots or your African roots and things like that, because right. like you just want to like essentially get rid of all of that and just create this like unified race, and like, and that's really ugly, right? Like it's also eugenics. It gets right. very close right. to eugenics. So, but that's sort of like that was like a big movement in Latin America. And I don't really know, you know, I don't live there anymore. My family, like half of my family still does, like my father's family is all still there. So when I go there, I feel like a tourist in my own country. But you know, I still love everything. I still love like the good and the bad right. of it.
Sure. So this is sort of like, this manifests itself in the book as, so like you go back and forth, right, between a modern, a contemporary, and then you go back in time to tell Orquídea's story, which is just, I mean, what a life. it's so incredible. I mean, the good, the bad, the ugly, right? The unbelievable. Part of me wants to see this like, you know, visually, but at the same time, I'm like, no, someone will ruin it. So just leave it alone, right? But so anyways, the contemporary side of this, you've got like Miramar Ray and Tatinelli and her daughter, of course, Rian. And part of that, you know, they go on this journey themselves and learning about Orquídea's past, right, to sort of uncover this. I mean, it's kind of a mystery, I guess, right, to find out the roots of everything that's happening. And, you know, they end up going back in time themselves and, you know, metaphorically. Talk about sort of this balance between, you know, you, in a sense, they're us, right? They're the ones taking us on this journey in back in time. Talk about balancing the two, right? The contemporary versus the old. Maybe this is more of an editing process question. Like, was there at one point, this book is plotted very well. It reads very, it's to me, it's a very easy read. Not that it's simplistic, right? You know what I'm saying? Like,
No, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
That came with a lot of editing.
Okay.
You know, we moved a lot of scenes around. I also had to flesh a lot of the past out because the past is so traumatic for Orquídea and important. And at the same time, like you're seeing this past and then but like her descendants don't know anything about it.
Right.
And like they can't know until she tells them. Right. But she can't for several reasons. And so it, you know, like I really wanted to go hard on the dramatic irony. Mm-hmm. The past was also difficult to write because the neighborhood where we grew up in didn't really exist before like my family moved over there.
Okay.
Right. And so like, I asked like my grandmother, okay, like what did it look like in the 40s? And they're like, there's nothing here in the 40s. Like it's just like a long strip of like it's like a long street that leads to the river. And there were no houses and stuff like that. So I just sort of had to make that up as I went along. And I looked at all these like old photos of Guayaquil and so it just became a process of like learning about my own country in a different way, because like there are things I knew, obviously, like I, you know, even from a young age, like you learn about the important figures of Latin America, like Simón Bolívar and like the liberators of Latin America. Mm-hmm. But I just like, I was intentionally learning about like the flora and the fauna, and going deeper into the legends like Guayas and Kil, who were Huancavilca indigenous peoples, a prince and a princess, right? And so like learning, it was just so much fun. Like the research parts of it were my favorite part, because like I got to dig deeper into my favorite things, which is like old stories.
And that's like, again, a lot of it is like, because our point of view is through, you know, the contemporary people in this book, right? And you mm-hmm. know, yes, it, you know, Arcadia, it ends up sort of like she's the one telling us these stories. We're living through her, but it's being, you know, witnessed through the eyes of these younger kids in the contemporary side of this story. And it's a very, like I said, it's an old world versus new world. There's these ideas, you know, sort of coming together, and I think it's a really great book for, I think, kids to read, to maybe help them appreciate and understand the past a bit better. And that there is, mm-hmm. that by embracing the past and understanding the past, the good, the bad, the ugly, you know, can only help us now in the present, right? And I really love that about sort of the end of this book is so great. And, you know, the lessons learned go beyond magic, you know what I mean? To me, it's just like basic humanity at the end of it.
Yeah.
But it's dressed up so cosmically beautifully. It's just, it's like, it's hard to see, but at the same time, not hard to see. You know what I mean? I think you really you just so deftly like wrote this story with it's such a great way. Like, because it's not allegorical. It's you, because it's wound so tightly into the story, into the plot. But at the same time, you get to the end of it and you're like, yeah. And you just fucking feel better about yourself. And you it's like better about the world, because these people are out there in the world. There's people like Arcadia out there in the world. And you're just like, I want to know these people, because I just feel like being around them will make me a better person.
Yeah. And I mean, like it so much a story about like finding yourself and accepting that version of yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the book has so much, like I said before, like it has so much of myself, but it also has like so much of what I love is like creating magical stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I really get to play with a different type of format and a different type of, because I get asked a lot, like whether or not this book could be YA, and I have some people saying that like they're going to like give it to their high schools. And I'm like, please don't. I don't like, I think that, you know, just because a book has a young character in it, right? Like in some instances we see Arcadia Divina as a young girl. It's still not young adult. It's still not a YA novel. And I like, I think teens are tough, right? Like, but at the same time, like, it's not a book that I would be like, oh, here, go give it to your teenager.
Right. Well, it's not, I think that would be a unique teenager for this book to appeal to them for sure. Concerned with other things in the world at that point in their life. Right. And then the stuff we usually equate with YA or whatever, but at its core though, I think this could reach a wider audience, but I do agree though, like, yeah, let's keep it at,
yeah,
probably keep it at high schools. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like, no, I like get some angry parents. Like,
well, know, because it's like you said, I mean, Christ, we are doing such a good job of not discussing any details about this book, I think. Cause I'm fucking bursting at the seams here. Like I want to talk about this book, but yeah. Arcadia, like we go back and there's some unpleasant stuff. Right, to say the least, that happens mm-hmm. in this book, and it's fine. It's not like hyper realized. It's not fantastical. Like that's the interesting thing about this book too, is that there's a ton of crazy shit in it. There's a ton of weird magic shit, and mm-hmm. and some like I'll say cosmically weird magic too. There's some weird stuff going on in this book, but it feels so natural. It feels so grounded, and I think that's because you tie it to this culture in a way that makes it feel natural. The way you describe, you know, Guayaquil and you know, and the people, and it feels so natural to me. It just makes sense in a way. That's the only way I can describe it, is everything in this book makes sense. Like if somebody said this to me, like, yeah, I'd buy it. I'd be like, yeah, sure. Of course. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so,
that's just like a compliment essentially to your writing, but
thank you.
Yeah,
I think the thing about magical realism is that like it's really the magic in the mundane, right? Yeah, like the everyday. And
sure, but you admit though there's some American stuff in the second half of this book though that gets a little more, less mundane, a little more, yes. Right? There's some wacky stuff, but not wacky in a bad way or even comical. For lack of a better word, but there's some crazy stuff that I think that like that you just, but you temper it so well. And like, because I mean, you read a lot too, so some of this stuff you can lose control of it, can't you, in a hurry? And it really takes over the narrative of the book, I think. And I've read books where the magic gets out of hand and you lose sight of what's important or the message, I think, because of the flash and bang, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you just tempered it so well in this book. And it's like, there's a move you pull at the end. I'm just, people are going to hate this episode because they don't know what we're talking about.
They're like, what are you talking about?
I know. Please just trust me. Like, it's so great. And this has just been, there's less questions, just more compliments, I understand. But it's hard to sort of.
Writers never get tired of those comments.
Of course.
I mean, like most of the time we're like, we don't believe them. It's just like, okay, great.
Oh yeah. No, well, listen,
I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, there's one thing too, like, I have some rules with this show is I won't invite an author on unless I like the book. So I've turned down way more than authors that I talk to for that reason. So I just don't, because it's we live one life.
I appreciate that so much.
But it's just one of those things where you want people to, again, this comes back to sort of like, just this feels like, just like, this is storytelling. This is the way all books should be told, not specific to the details of this book, obviously, right? But it just feels like this is a story that's, I think this is, when I said timeless, I mean, this feels like a classic already to me. This feels like people are going to be talking about this book for a long time because of what Melanie said too, right? It just feels, it just feels, you know, it's got the, gives you the feels. And and it's a huge cast too. And I mean, you do such a great job with this cast. The Montoyas are fucking, there's so many Montoyas and offshoots and branches and right, literally. And you do such
I would have to do that map with my own family, I feel.
Do you have a big, yeah, because I don't have a big family. Yeah, so it's like,
I have a huge family.
Do you? And the thing is, it's not even, and then it's not even just the living, right? You incorporate the dead as well.
Yeah,
and puts more chairs at the table. And that dining room table is huge. And it's, you do such a great job with this cast too, because again, that's another thing that can spin out of control, right? With large casts and you do such a great job.
I mean, you know, one of the things that like I really strive for is, there was a time in, I think, I remember tweeting in the early aughts, like I think like 2012 or something like that, 2013, I think. And I asked Twitter for like, I was like, I need suggestions of fantasy books written by and about like Latinx people, Latinos. Mm-hmm. I got like three suggestions that were actually right. Like, and none of them were by Latin authors. Right. And out of those three books, I was like, only two of these are really like Latino fantasies, right? The other one was Ray Carson's The Girl of Fire and Thorn, which it is Spanish inspired, but it's not Latinx. I really like the first book of that. It's another like a trilogy that I keep meaning to finish, but mm-hmm. I haven't. But it's really, but it, you know, I really like Ray Carson. But then in 2014, 2016, there's Danny Jose Older, mm-hmm. right? And then there's me writing like the Brooklyn Brew. So like Daniel and I have like the Brooklyn Brewha series. Then you have Adam right. Silvera writing like speculative fiction into his contemporary worlds. And then it just sort of like exploded, right? Like we have like the Latin explosion with Anna Marie McElmore and Lily Rivera. And so it just became this like, I feel really honored to be able to write in this space. And I hope to see more Latinx authors in adult fantasy and adult sci-fi.
Yeah.
Not just in the YA space. So, yeah.
YA is a good, because it's, we're still in the middle of it. Maybe it's a bit of a renaissance, right, for YA right now. And it's so accessible. Mm-hmm. It's so accessible. I can see that's a really nice way to sort of enter the market, right? But I agree, especially now that we know what certain authors are capable of too, right? I mean, now that I've read, like you said, Aidan Thomas or whoever, right? Like, the chops are there, right? And so it's, everyone's like, hey, these guys, and gals are fucking great writers. You know what I mean? Let's see them even go the other way. Let's see a middle grade, right? Let's see, whatever. So yeah, I'm with you. Like, I would love to see more adult. And there's so many books I've read too, where YA, where I'm just like, this needs to be adult. Okay. So whether it's new adult or whatever, I don't know, but I've read a lot of YA lately where I'm just like, this needs to be adult. And I just feel mm-hmm. like, it's like the temptation is there, but at the same time, it's like, well, YA is just more accessible. So I'm like, I hope that's not the case, right? I hope they just wanted to write a YA book and that's great. But this idea, I like what you said earlier, this idea of just because the MC is 18 doesn't automatically mean the book has to be a young adult book.
Right. So. Right. Yeah. I mean, most fantasy, like, I feel like all of the fantasy I read has like a young, like early 20 something. And like, that's just how fantasy just is.
Right.
For the most part, like, I don't think that we need to call it new adult. I think like, that's just always like, it's just adult fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. And so I think like, it's, yeah, I mean, I'm excited for what the future holds in all things, but especially, this book coming out in September, it's a long time coming. And so I'm very excited. We have a pre-order campaign that we're actually holding until a little after release date.
Okay.
So, that's exciting as well. I don't think I've had a publisher do that.
Okay, that is cool, actually. That is a good idea. I assume those details will be on your website and then shared on social and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay.
Do you have any launch day events planned?
I do have a few launch day events. I'm still waiting for confirmation on them. But okay.
Yeah, I guess it's a little too early. Yeah.
When is this episode going up?
This will be out either the day before or the day of.
Okay, yeah. So it'll be, I have all of my launch day events will be on my website for this week.
Perfect. Zoretta, I can't thank you enough. I mean, we haven't even scratched the surface of this thing. I mean, I was, it's like, wait till people like Lozero, like Bolivar Londono III, like, come on, how'd you come up with that guy? Just like on the characters in this book are just, people aren't going to be ready for it. The thing, there's no sag in this story to me. Like, this, each act is just as good as the others, and the second act in this book is like, we really get into the meat of Arcadia and the stuff that she went through. And that's the thing too, is like, decades passed in this book, but it doesn't feel, it just goes by like that. It's so, but not in a bad way. Like, it's so great, and I can't wait for people to read this book. I'm so happy for you, Zoraida, and I'm gonna stand you in this book. So
thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I hope whoever is listening also goes and picks up a copy.
I hope so too. They better. There could be I could see a sequel. I don't know.
No, it is definitely a standalone. Definitely a standalone. All right.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yes. You're an old pro. So I don't know. Do you still lose sleep the night before release?
Yeah, like the week before launch, I'm always a disaster. So,
all right. Well, try and get some sleep, anyways, if you can, and have a great launch. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
There you have it. Another episode of Everything is Canon All Wrapped Up. Huge thanks to Zoraida for taking time from her travels to speak with me. It's clear I love this book dearly. So please pick up a copy so we can continue to get stories such as this. The Inheritance of Arcadia Divina is out now, so please pick up a copy wherever books are sold and head on over to ZoraidaCordova.com to find out more information. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen and head on over to CineLinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.
Bye.